Hi, I'm Scott Kessler of the Broadly Game, and on this edition of the Philadelphia Union Unnamed Podcast, I have Dens from SB Nation's Real Salt Lake Blog RSL Soapbox, and I have Michael C. Lewis of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you for coming on, guys.
No problem. Happy to be here.
All right, so last week we saw a game in which the Union dominated the first half, and Real Salt Lake finally came around to what a lot of people thought they would do this year, and that was, you know, come back, score goals on good shots. Not, you know, they don't have to dominate. They don't have the forwards currently because of injuries and otherwise to do so. But they showed a lot of good play with depth in the second half of that game. So, what did you guys think about the first half versus the second half? And I'll ask Mike to start off first.
Well, I think you probably can't get very far without saying they were so drastically different from Real Salt Lake's perspective. I mean, that first half was just, it was an absolute disaster, you'd have to say. And frankly, they were lucky they weren't down maybe 4-0, because I think in addition to the goal that the Union scored, there was, I think Nick Raimondo made a pretty spectacular save. I think the Union hit the bar in a post, and it seemed like there might have been another offside or something that they had a good chance on, or, you know, they were really, the Union were just all over them, and Real Salt Lake just didn't look like they were ready to play. And I think it was even Jason Kreis, the coach, who after the game called it abysmal in the first half, and obviously the second, you know, may not have been brilliant soccer, but it's, you know, it got them back on the board, and they played, is certainly from their perspective, much, much better. To the point that they feel like that was actually a, you know, could be kind of a good stepping stone, they hope, into better form going forward. Because if those halves had been reversed and they played, you know, the way they played in the second half first and then followed that up with such a bad, you know, bad 45 minutes in the second half, they'd have been coming home here probably dazed and confused and figuring where they're going to go next. So they're fortunate in a way that it went the way it did.
And, Denz, what do you think about Mike's comments on the first half versus the second half?
I certainly have to agree. I was pretty amazed that we only gave up one goal, just the scoring opportunities. And, you know, while RSL had some possession, it was almost all negative possession. You know, the ball wasn't getting out of their half of the pitch very much. The one thing I will say that I thought was one of those huge differences is it was clear that Robbie Russell hadn't played in a couple games, and he really seemed to struggle in that first half to adapt to how Philadelphia was attacking.
I did note Robbie has shaved off that magnificent beard that he had during the CONCACAF championship run up to the finals, and I hate to make this analogy, but is he Samson? You know, could it be that psychological thing?
I think it's probably more simply he had been recovering from a little bit of an injury, you know, and probably wasn't quite back to full match fitness. I mean, we've seen this year that Robbie Russell is stronger and faster than he's ever been. He came into preseason camp just, I mean, he literally looked like an MMA fighter. You take away the beard even. He was in really great shape. And so I think when you're out with an injury for a few weeks and all of a sudden you have to come back in and try to adjust a little bit back to how a team is playing. And let's be honest, the Philadelphia Union this year aren't the same team they were last year. They play a very different style. I was really impressed with how aggressive they played against RSL. And recently they had become a much more aggressive team than the grinded out team that had started the season. So I think we might have got caught a little off guard in that first half.
Yeah, I would think you'd probably be hard-pressed to make the same analogy quite that strongly, given all of the other factors that have played into Real Salt Lake's dip in form in the last few weeks. If they had everybody and everybody healthy, and the only thing that was different was Robbie shaved his beard, then maybe we'd have something. But sadly, only one very, very minor thing that's factored in for them.
I tried to introduce a little bit of humor and wit, so so I came up with a little biblical allusion. One of the talking points, Thank you. One of the talking points for this game was Espíndola's goal. Now, it was a great shot, as he said after the game. He was looking at Mondragon before the game started, saw he's tall. He is a rather tall man, and decided to put it low and hard to the outside and try to force him, to make the diving save, and he beat him because of that. But it wasn't actually the goal that was the talking point. It was the build up to it. Do you think there was a foul on Michael Farfan, or do you think that the referee got the call correct?
Des, maybe you better take that one, because I did not see it spectacularly, and it has struck me that it's probably one of those plays that you could probably make either call and be able to defend it. You know what I mean? That one ref might call it one way, and another ref might call it another, and it's not so egregious either way that you couldn't see it, being a decent call either way it went.
And I can definitely see that opinion. That match had, if it were just that play that didn't get called, but we saw in the first half and we saw in the second half that physical play was being allowed at a level that actually is quite surprising, given how most officials are officiating MLS matches. So when you look at all the physical plays that occurred during the match that didn't get called, I think it becomes a lot less egregious. Yes, it led to a goal. It was minor contact. It certainly wasn't an intentional foul by Alexander. It looked really like their legs got tangled up a little bit, and not much more than that. I don't think I could call that, a huge... I certainly wouldn't make the big deal out of it that Peter did after the match.
I mean, Farfan thought he was fouled. Espíndola wasn't asked about it, from what I could see about from quotes after the game. And obviously Novak did make a big to-do about it. He made a big to-do about all the refereeing throughout the game. And I think he did have a reasonable point about the referee that game, but everybody did. The referee was calling things that really weren't fouls, and then he wasn't calling things that really should have been fouls, yellow carding people for fouls that were weaker than fouls that he, wasn't calling. And that was more Novak's point, I think, than whether or not Farfan was fouled. There has to be some sort of consistency in the game, because, like he said, a lot of the fouls that went on in that game weren't fouls against the Rapids, but then a lot of the fouls that weren't fouls in this game were fouls when they were playing against the Rapids. So from week to week, we're seeing different types of styles of referee calls, and when you come into a game like this and you have a pivotal moment where one side thinks it's a definite foul and the other side thinks that it's just the run of play in a physical game, I think that a lot of questions come up about whether or not there's a consistent level of officiating, whether or not it's in the league or just among some of the higher profile referees.
So that would wonder, in what sport is that not the case? I dare you to find me one that there's not. I mean, in baseball, you adjust to different umpires who have different strike zones every game, and in the NBA, some games have 50 free throws, and some games barely have any, and referees call it tighter or looser, and it varies from game to game. So I'm kind of surprised sometimes that in MLS, coaches waste so much time, seemingly, complaining about that supposed lack of consistency in the referees, as if you're going to have the same guy doing the same things and seeing it the same things every game. And I just don't know that there's a sport anywhere that actually exists.
I think that is fair, but see, some of the examples you brought up, here's the thing about baseball. You expect each referee to have a different strike zone because of the human element, just like you expect each referee of a different level of physicality when it comes to calling the game. But in baseball, a strike is a strike is a strike is a strike. I mean, it could be 2 inches off the plate. It could be right on the plate. Some people call the inside, some people don't. But going into the game, how that person's going to call it. But if you look at a referee like Toledo or anybody else in Major League Soccer, you don't know game to game how that person's going to be calling it. And that's really the problem. It's not whether or not each referee is calling it exactly the same way. It's that the referees themselves are not calling their own games consistently. And in the long run, if you don't keep a consistent style of refereeing, it doesn't matter what sport you're in, it's going to cause confusion for players and for coaches, and it's going to change how the game's played. Instead of letting the players dictate how the game is going to, to result, you're going to have the referees doing way too much of the dictating.
Well, I can see that. what referees are, you know, certain referees and how they tend to call games, whether they're tighter, looser, you know, good or bad. Very similar to the way referees are viewed by coaches in other sports. I'm just not sure it's all that different. But, Dez, what do you think?
Well, I think we're stuck in a dilemma where the vast majority of officials that are in MLS matches are full-time. They aren't highly paid. And so the development and the training that goes into them simply isn't as in-depth as it may need to be. You know, MLS is still a small league. It's a young league. U.S. Soccer runs all the officials. They do their reviews. Every match has some official from U.S. Soccer or MLS. They're reviewing the performance of the officials. I think at the start of the season, we saw just way too many cards and fouls being called. I think U.S. Soccer and MLS sent definitely had some conversations with the officials and said, you know, we're stopping the match too much. It's not the style we want. So then I think we've seen it kind of swing the other way where a bit less is being called. I also think we've got a lot of really young and new officials that are coming into the league who are calling things different. You know, I think Jason Christ hit it on the head. I think it was last year. He said, you go out and you play. If you let the official tell you how you're going to play, if you let the official, you know, dictate everything that's going to happen, the game loses everything that it has. So if you instead just go out and play, and if the calls go against you, then you know what not to do for the rest of the game. If you go out, though, and you just don't do anything because you're afraid of the officials, then the game loses some of that element. And I think every coach has calls that they think go against them. Every call, every coach will never tell you, hey, we got a good call. You know, it's the nature of every sport. I've never heard an NFL head coach in a post-match, oh, that official got every call right. He was perfect. He did great. You just don't hear that. What you always hear is the negative. Something goes against them or something isn't the way they would like it to be, then it's bad. Yes, there's a level of inconsistency, and it simply comes with a level of experience. And it comes with the fact that I think we still have 4 full-time paid officials. Everybody else is a part-timer. You know, it's hard to get a level of consistency if the guy's only doing, you know, working 1.5 hours a week or a month. You know, that's kind of a hard thing to expect is a level of professional consistency from them.
That's a good point, Dez. And, you know, another aspect, too, is even the ones who are full-time get criticized, be it in Major League Soccer or the NFL or the Premier League or La Liga. The coaches in those leagues complain about referees just the same. And so even if you potentially have referees, you have more referees who are better trained and, you know, more of them who are full-time, it's certainly not going to eliminate missed calls or, you know, inconsistencies from one game to the next. And especially you won't eliminate coaches complaining about it all the time, because I think Dez is exactly right that, you know, coaches are fine with refs until refs make a call against their team, and then the ref is terrible.
That is a fair point. Another thing that was brought up during the game, and I posted this on the Brotherly game because I was sitting right where it happened. I was a row above it. But Fabian Espindola, he didn't exactly like the Sons of Ben prior to halftime, as he and other Real Salt Lake players came around sections 138 and 137 of the river end towards the players' tunnel, which is between sections 137 and 136. And one reason why Garber has said no stadium will ever be designed like PPL Park again, he came in between those two sections to go through the tunnel and ended up flipping off the fans. And I posted it because, you know, even though I don't have any photographic or video proof, I did ask people who were in the area if anybody had it, but nobody's expecting stuff like that to happen. We've seen, especially in the Philadelphia with some of our athletes, we've seen players like Allen Iverson flip off fans and be fined, you know, almost $10,000. Michael Vick, when he was still in the Falcons, was fined. It was something like $10,000 or $20,000 for flipping off his own fans. Stuff like this, we see it in other sports where other leagues don't like players acting out against fans. And the problem with Major League Soccer is that a lot of the, I don't want to say hardcore, but some of the more, I guess you could say, some of the more hardcore fans, the supporter groups, they hate the fact that Major League Soccer tries to be this family-friendly league to try to get fans to come in, the casual ones. And a lot of them just shrugged it off, saying, hey, you know, we got to them. This is just a sign that the Sons of Ben are doing their quote-unquote job. But do you see this kind of reaction as the unprofessionalism that shouldn't be in the league, no matter what kind of league it's trying to turn itself into? Or do you think that it's fine for a professional athlete to display his emotions in such a way?
Dan, why don't you hit that one?
Oh, yeah, toss me that one. That's the way.
Well, I don't think it's too. I feel like I've been jumping all over him to start with.
Well, and you know, I started as one of the members of the RCB, the Rogue Cavaliers Brigade. So I started in the stands, in the supporter group. You know, I still am active with those guys, even though I spend, you know, my time on the sidelines taking pictures now. I think there's a fine line with players in reacting. You know, I go back to when Real Madrid came to Rice-Eccles Stadium with David Beckham, you know, and some of the things that were said to him that he clearly heard and reacted to. Definitely not flipping off fans, but he reacted, and you knew he heard you. You know, I've seen both positive and negative reactions from players. You know, some take it as a high form of a compliment, you know, that you're willing as a fan to single them out, to taunt them, to try and affect them. You know, there's no better example of that than Ben Olsen up at Rice-Eccles, I want to say 4 years ago, when every time the guy touched the ball, we were doing Ben Olsen Geico caveman chants. And after the match, he came over to the fans, signed the poster that was designed with a picture of him and the Geico caveman. He thought it was the funniest thing he'd seen all year. Should players be flipping off or swearing at fans? No, they shouldn't be. But in the emotion of a game, the emotion of this sport, which probably more than any other has an interaction between the fans and especially the supporter groups and the players, is that going to happen from time to time? Absolutely, it's going to happen. Should the league look into it? If the league sees something, if the league, you know, if it's seen on TV, if it's caught on film, I definitely think they should have a talk with the player. They should give them a warning that type of behavior isn't acceptable. You know, Fabian is an incredibly emotional guy. He plays with his heart on his sleeve every time he's on the pitch. And nobody on RSL had a good first half, so I could see if some taunts were perhaps getting to him, that he might overreact in that way. Certainly can't condone it, but do I think there should be a huge investigation into it? Probably not, because I've seen, you know, plenty of keepers at Rio Tinto have not exactly been polite to the fans behind them either.
Yeah, I would say that there just can't be any place for a reaction like that from a player to fans. Part of the deal, part of being a professional, is knowing you're going to hear stuff you don't want to hear, you know, no matter what professional sport you're in. And, you know, once it becomes okay to flip off the fans, then it becomes okay to swear back at the fans, and you're just taking baby steps toward, you know, the brawl in the palace, or, you know, baseball players climbing in the stands to fight with fans. And I know that sounds pretty, you know, it's pretty easy to say, oh, come on, it was just a, you know, this is one little thing. But, you know, that sort of behavior, it just can't happen if you want to be a serious, real professional league. You know, you can kind of let it take a pass, and then maybe over time it becomes part of the culture or whatever. But I think that really puts at risk, puts at jeopardy the reputation of the league and the players in it. I do think that if that had been caught on some manner, this is the first I'd heard of it, quite honestly, and I would think that if that had been caught on film, you know, on tape, or some TV station, or somebody had watched Fabian do that, I do think the league would have looked into it and you know, possibly even fined him, depending on, you know, what they found to have happened and so forth. But there's just, emotional as it is and all that, there just can't be any place for reactions like that from players to fans.
It's funny that you say, you know, TV cameras and all that. There's a TV camera pointed towards the field at that moment, 5 feet away. So
is that right? Just looking the wrong direction?
wrong direction, but the referees were actually right behind him, all four of them. And and I wasn't looking at their faces. I'm paying attention to the guy who just, you know, indirectly flipped me off. And I'm told that they were laughing. They thought it was funny because I'm guessing that a lot of them have seen worse. And but I just, of all people, you know, you think that the referees would go over to him and say, maybe funny, but cool your jets.
Let's calm that down just a little bit. Yeah, I would be surprised to know that was the reaction. Like I said, that just can't be the way that the league is going to want either its players or its referees to react to a situation like that.
Right. On more of a union-related note now, but still tying into Real Salt Lake, of course, Chris Agorsor was released by the union recently, and Michael, you spotted him at one of the practices this week as one of the three trials that Real Salt Lake has now brought in, and MajorLeagueSoccer.com confirmed it, of course. Do either of you think that he has a chance of making the team? There's an article today that RSL is looking for speed, something that apparently Christ thinks they're lacking currently, and Agorsor is speed. That's what he's known for. So is he looking like he might make the team? I know that, Michael, you tweeted that Christ has said that none of the trials have really set themselves apart, but has he in your eyes at all?
You know, to be honest, it's hard for me to tell whether he really has. I have not seen full training sessions this week with him, and it's a little bit hard to tell how he or anybody really kind of shapes up, in part because Real Salt Lake is missing so many guys that they're to some degree still kind of disjointed in the sense that, you know, it's not coming as easily for everybody. Everybody's kind of still getting used to playing with different guys and in different combinations than they have before. And sometimes in that case, it's a little bit hard to judge. I do think that among the trialists, based purely on his position and his talents, he probably has the best chance, I would think, because Real Salt Lake is so shorthanded without guys up top at the moment. And, you know, their real fast guy this year would have been Paulo Jr., and he's been on the shelf with an injury and probably still will be for probably a couple weeks yet. I think there's a chance that they wind up signing him? Yeah, perhaps. And maybe Jason Christ today was just kind of sandbagging a little bit when he was so abrupt in saying that, nope, none of the trials have really shown anything yet. And, you know, maybe that's the truth because they've only been there a few days, but it may also be that he's just trying to not show his hand. It does seem like Real Salt Lake could use a fast striker, particularly at the moment, more than they could use, a midfielder or even an outside back. On the other hand, they just did add a new striker just a couple of weeks ago, and who's started to work his way into the lineup now, Arthur Agassian, and they will be getting their best players back in the coming weeks. So, you know, do you sign the guy now, knowing you may have to make a roster move to clear some space for him, and knowing that by the time he's in top form, you know, you would have had other guys back, or is he good enough and fast enough that that doesn't matter? That I think is the part that remains to be seen.
Denz, what do you think about a player who the union felt they couldn't give enough time to develop, which was sort of I'd say it was more of he's not fitting in with the team whatsoever. We don't see him progressing on to the point where he's going to become even a fourth option or striker on the team behind a Jack McInerney, Danny Mwanga, you know, those kind of players, to possibly being in a first team for Real Salt Lake, where at the beginning of the season we saw the supposed RSL B team, you know, crush, who was it, the New England Revolution? I mean, it seems like such a short period of time for a scrap heap player to be a focus point possibly for a team like RSL.
Well, you know, I don't know about scrap heap players. You know, Yeromont Sissian was a scrap heap player in Kansas City. He did pretty well here, and he's doing pretty well in Europe. Robbie Finley was a scrap heap player at LA who came in, did really well for RSL.
He's still a scrap heap player.
And has moved on. You know, so scrap heap players in this league
coming up in the next 6 weeks. I think if you've got a guy, you know, who may have struggled somewhere else simply just because he's young, he's not getting playing time, you know, Philly's got a pretty young team up top, you know, some really good young talent. RSL could definitely use another player, young, speedy player, not knowing what the future holds with the injury with to Paulo Jr. It's taken longer to recover. You know, we've got Cody Arnaud, who's still recovering from the injury. Sabo hasn't exactly looked himself since off-season injury recovery and the surgery he went through. So I think definitely having a little bit of depth might just be enough to get him on at least a short-term contract. And having a player that's got a pretty good reputation, you know, whether you can use him for the full season or whether you have to look at trading him down the line, if he can get him some minutes and showcase his skills, he definitely might have some additional value beyond just being able to fill in for you for, say, the next 8 to 10 weeks.
It's interesting to bring up Cody Arnaud. He was actually, of the three players that were available in MLS lotteries this offseason, he was the one that I pushed for the Union to go after simply because he's a bigger striker, and it was something that the Union were still looking for at the time. And when you lose Alejandro Moreno, you need someone to fulfill that role of playing through a striker. And I thought Cody Arnaud, of the three players that were available, had the best opportunity to not only make the Union but also make a contribution. Instead, they pick up in a separate lottery, they pick up a Gorsor, who basically was Jeremiah White, who they decided cost them too much money during the preseason, did not sign, and basically the same as their third round super draft pick, Levi Huapu, who I think, Denz, you know I love, from back during our mock draft days in January for SB Nation. And it just seems like they spent all this time trying to get him to come in, and he ends up having a ton of offside calls against him in reserve leagues. Just seems kind of like an abrupt way of getting rid of a player that they spent so much time on. And I don't know if this is a simple scrap heap situation. He had the terrible knee injury, which even led to him only being paid $42,000 this season. He was supposed to be a Generations Adidas player. He thought he was going to be able to be picked up by a major European side coming out of freshman year. There are a lot of question marks surrounding Chris Agorsor, and I don't know, even if he makes Real Salt Lake, if we're ever going to see the Chris Agorsor that we should see.
That very well could be. You know, the simple reality is, I kind of like the way RSL has taken some of these strikers who are willing to come off of injuries. We've got some time. You know, even with the injuries that we've had and the calls we've had, our depth isn't bad. You know, we certainly didn't expect that we, out of our four potential strikers, that we would have three of them gone at the same time, one with an injury and two to national team call-ups. It certainly wasn't something we were anticipating. So when you get a young guy, you know, offside calls, that just means he's on that edge. You know, I think Jesus Christ said it about a Spindola 3 or 4 weeks ago. He's that little bit of a step. It's the razor's edge that you go with. Sometimes you're on the right side, sometimes you're on the wrong side. I think Jason, having been a striker in the league and been, you know, a very successful striker, understands what it takes to work with and develop young strikers. I think it simply comes down to a matter of, does RSL have a spot? Can they get him under their cap? And is he willing to understand and take some coaching and understand that here, our strikers play defense. You know, the most impressive play against the Union was Fabian Espíndola running 30 yards up a counterattack. To me, that was the play of the game for RSL. It wasn't the goal. It was the fact that we probably were going to give up another goal that had not been for an incredible defensive run from a striker to go and break up an offensive opportunity for the Union.
Yeah, you know, a lot goes into whether, I think, often, whether a player is a, quote, scrap heap player for one organization or the other, and Denz brings up some very good examples of those: salary cap constraints, other players on your roster, your schedule, and what that looks like. It may not always be that player X dislikes player A and needs to get rid of them. There often are other reasons that factor in, and I'm not done what those might have been entirely for the Union. But, you know, Real Salt Lake has done a pretty good job of finding guys that they can work with that Vince suggested and who are willing to take the coaching and do the things that they ask. And, you know, that it just may be in some cases where even the scenario, the teammates, the locker room, the atmosphere, the who knows what about one particular team doesn't suit the player quite the same way as it does in another place. And, you know, Euro Mustachian is probably a pretty good example of that, as Ben suggested. And so, you know, you see, so I think you see that happen a fair bit where one guy in one place looks like, you know, we don't really need him, or maybe we don't want him, or we think we don't want him, and he goes somewhere else and he does really, really well. So, you know, it's kind of hard to say. I do think the one thing about Chris is, by all accounts, he's pretty darn fast. And, you know, you're right. That is one thing that RSL is lacking, particularly right now with so many strikers gone, is speed up top to get in behind defenses. And, you know, you can't coach speed, or, you know, only to a certain extent can you. And so if you got a guy who's fast, he's probably always going to have a chance at it.
And the last question, thank you guys again for coming on to this podcast, is there have been some rumors going around that Christ or Novak could be the possible successors to Bob Bradley if the USSF thinks that he isn't doing a good enough job with this year's Gold Cup. Do you think either coach has the opportunity to take over for Bradley in that case? And would you have a favorite between those two? And I am asking you to take yourselves away from Real Salt Lake in this situation, because obviously you'd rather have Novak if that was the case.
Jeez, what do you think, Dan? I think Jason would love to be the national team coach at some point.
I think you're right. I Jason's a pragmatic, very thoughtful guy. He's a detailed guy. I think if when you pose a question to him, he kind of sidesteps it. And that's because I think Jason eventually would love that opportunity. But I think Jason would be probably the first person off camera, you know, away from the microphone to say, I'm just not ready yet. We've got to remember that Jason's only been a head coach, not even three full seasons yet. You know, and it's not a lot of experience to go in and take over a national team. Peter's got a lot more experience, definitely more exposure internationally than Jason's had. So I think either one of them long-term would make a good coach. I just think Jason's probably going to, just for himself to feel prepared and really feel ready for that challenge, probably want a few more years of coaching. You know, I've heard some really off-the-wall rumors about him maybe having some guys and organizations in Europe looking at him. You know, I don't think Jason's in a hurry to leave, but I definitely think he's looking always for a good challenge, and I think he still feels that he has a really good challenge in front of him here at RSL.
I think Dens is just about right on the nose on that. Peter certainly is the more experienced coach. I don't know, maybe it comes down to the kind of style you want your national team to play if it comes down to trying to choose a new coach. And as much as I agree about Jay, you know, I can't speak a whole lot to what Peter's aspirations might be and how he might fit in there, because I just don't know him well or you know enough about the way he would administer a program. But as far as Jason goes, I the knock on him, as Dens mentioned, is, you know, gosh, is he ready? Is he experienced enough? And to a certain degree, I wonder if that's not overblown. I mean, it's basically the same job, right? I mean, you're coaching a team, you're building a program. Yes, it's at a different level, and there are different aspects to it, and of course, there's a lot more pressure probably coaching a national team than there is a, you know, quote, just another team in the league. But, you know, you're effectively doing the same job. You're making the same sorts of decisions and judgments and so forth. And if you're good at doing that in one place, it seems plausible to think you could be good doing it at another. Of course, that doesn't always work out that way. But and as much as I don't think Jason is eager to, you know, he's not searching for an exit strategy by any stretch of the imagination here at Real Salt Lake, I think he probably could be happy here for quite a while. It's also true that if the opportunity were to arise, ready or not, you know, maybe you feel, oh gosh, maybe he's not quite ready, or I'm not quite there yet, you're not turning it down. If it were to ever come up, you go and take it, because it might not come up again. You know, who ever knows what might happen in the future? Maybe the guy they wind up hiring instead is turns out to be the longest serving coach in U.S. soccer history, and by the time he's even gone, you're past your prime and nobody wants to hire you anymore. Who knows? So I don't think there's a scenario where it's a possibility. Probably this probably goes for Peter too. If the possibility's there and you ever aspire to take it, you take it when the opportunity is there. You don't say, well, maybe next time. I'll wait and see. Maybe I'll be more ready later. I don't think that's realistic thinking on behalf of a coach who would be in that situation.
Well, thank you both again for coming on to the Unnamed Philadelphia Union podcast. I'm Scott Kessler, the Brotherly Game. I was talking with Denz of SB Nation's Real Salt Lake blog, RSL Soapbox. You can find them at www.rslsoapbox.com. And our other guest was Michael C. Lewis of the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find him on Twitter at RSL Tribune. And you can also find Denz on Twitter at RSL Soapbox. Once again, guys, thank you for coming on and taking the time to speak to us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Glad to do it.